1. In Alice Springs, a grid of scorching streets where men in long white socks were forever getting in and out of land cruisers, I met a Russian who was mapping the sacred sites of the Aboriginals. His name was Arkady Volchok. He was an Australian citizen. He was 33 years old. His father, Ivan Volchok, was a Cossack from a village near Rostov-on-Don, who in 1942 was arrested and sent with a trainload of other Ostarbeiter to work in a German factory. One night, somewhere in the Ukraine, he jumped from the cattle car into a field of sunflowers. Soldiers in grey uniforms hunted him up and down the long lines of sunflowers, but he gave them the slip. Somewhere else, lost between murdering armies, he met a girl from Kiev and married her. Together they drifted to a forgettable Adelaide suburb, where he rigged up a vodka still and fathered three sturdy sons. The youngest of these was Arkady. Nothing in Arkady's temperament predisposed him to live in the hugger-mugger of Anglo-Saxon suburbia or take a conventional job. He had a flattish face and a gentle smile, and he moved through the bright Australian spaces with the ease of his footloose forebears. His hair was thick and straight, the colour of straw. His lips had cracked in the heat. He did not have the drawn-in lips of so many white Australians in the outback, nor did he swallow his words. He rolled his R's in a very Russian way. Only when you came up close did you realise how big his bones were. He had married, he told me, and had a daughter of six. Yet, preferring solitude to domestic chaos, he no longer lived with his wife. He had few possessions, apart from a harpsichord and a shelf of books. He was a tireless bushwalker. He thought nothing of setting out with a water flask and a few bites of food for a 100-mile walk along the ranges. Then he would come home, out of the heat and light, and draw the curtains and play the music of Buxtehude and Bach on the harpsichord. Their orderly progressions, he said, conformed to the contours of the Central Australian landscape. Neither of Arkady's parents had ever read a book in English. He delighted them by winning a first-class honours degree in history and philosophy at Adelaide University. He made them sad when he went to work as a schoolteacher on an Aboriginal settlement in Walbury country to the north of Alice Springs. He liked the Aboriginals. He liked their grit and tenacity and their artful ways of dealing with the white man. He had learnt, or half-learnt, a couple of their languages and had come away astonished by their intellectual vigour, their feats of memory and their capacity and will to survive. They were not, he insisted, a dying race, although they did need help, now and then, to get the government and mining companies off their backs. It was during his time as a schoolteacher that Arkady learned of the labyrinth of invisible pathways which meander all over Australia and are known to Europeans as dreaming tracks or song lines, to the Aboriginals as the footprints of the ancestors or the way of the law. Aboriginal creation myths tell of the legendary totemic beings who had wandered over the continent in the dream time, singing out the name of everything that crossed their path: birds, animals, plants, rocks, waterholes, and so singing the world into existence. Arkady was so struck by the beauty of this concept that he began to take notes of everything he saw or heard, not for publication, but to satisfy his own curiosity. At first, the Walbury elders mistrusted him, and their answers to his questions were evasive. With time, once he had won their confidence, they invited him to witness their most secret ceremonies and encouraged him to learn their songs. One year, an anthropologist from Canberra came to study Walbury systems of land tenure. An envious academic who resented Arkady's friendship with the songmen pumped him for information and promptly betrayed a secret he had promised to keep. Disgusted by the row that followed, the Russian threw in his job and went abroad. He saw the Buddhist temples of Java, sat with sadhus on the ghats of Benares, smoked hashish in Kabul, and worked on a kibbutz. On the Acropolis in Athens, there was a dusting of snow and only one other tourist, a Greek girl from Sydney. They travelled through Italy and slept together, and in Paris they agreed to get married. Having been brought up in a country where there was nothing, Arkady had longed all his life to see the monuments of Western civilization. He was in love. It was springtime. Europe should have been wonderful. It left him, to his disappointment, feeling flat. Often in Australia, he had had to defend the Aboriginals from people who dismissed them as drunken and incompetent savages. Yet there were times, in the fly-blown squalor of a Walbury camp, where he suspected they might be right, and that his vocation to help the blacks was either willful self-indulgence or a waste of time. Now, in a Europe of mindless materialism, his old men seemed wiser and more thoughtful than ever. He went to a Qantas office and bought 2 tickets home. He was married 6 weeks later in Sydney and took his wife to live in Alice Springs. She said she longed to live in the centre. She said she loved it when she got there. After a single summer, in a tin-roofed house that heated like a furnace, they began to drift apart. The Land Rights Act gave Aboriginal owners the title to their country, providing it lay untenanted. And the job Arkady invented for himself was to interpret tribal law into the language of the law of the Crown. No one knew better that the idyllic days of hunting and gathering were over, if indeed they were ever that idyllic. What could be done for Aboriginals was to preserve their most essential liberty, the liberty to remain poor, or, as he phrased it more tactfully, the space in which to be poor if they wished to be poor. Now that he lived alone, he liked to spend most of his time out bush. When he did come to town, he worked from a disused newspaper shop floor, where rolls of old newsprint still clogged the presses, and his sequences of aerial photos had spread, like a game of dominoes, over the shabby white walls. One sequence showed a 300-mile strip of country running roughly due north. This was the suggested route of a new Alice to Darwin railway. The line, he told me, was going to be the last long stretch of track to be laid in Australia, and its chief engineer, a railway man of the old school, had announced that it must also be the best. The engineer was close to retiring age and concerned for his posthumous reputation. He was especially concerned to avoid the kind of rumpus that broke out whenever a mining company moved its machinery into Aboriginal land. So, promising not to destroy a single one of their sacred sites, he had asked their representatives to supply him with a survey. Arkady's job was to identify the traditional landowners, to drive them over their old hunting grounds, even if these now belonged to a cattle company, and to get them to reveal which rock or soak or ghost gum was the work of a dreamtime hero. He had already mapped the 150-mile stretch from Alice to Middle Bore Station. He had 150 to go. "I warned the engineer he was being a bit rash," he said, "but that's the way he wanted it." "Why rash?" I asked. "Well, if you look at it their way," he grinned, "the whole of bloody Australia's a sacred site." "Explain," I said. He was on the point of explaining when an Aboriginal girl came in with a stack of papers. She was a secretary, a pliant brown girl in a brown knitted dress. She smiled and said, "Hi, Ark," but her smile fell away at the sight of a stranger. Arkady lowered his voice. He had warned me earlier how Aboriginals hate to hear white men discussing their business. "This is a Pom," he said to the secretary, "a Pom by the name of Bruce." The girl giggled diffidently, dumped the papers on the desk, and dashed for the door. "Let's go and get a coffee," he said. So we went to a coffee shop on Todd Street.